What's brought us here this weekend is the idea of coming together to form a community radio network, an idea which has been in the air. It's been done before with the Crab Nebula of stations, which is not a Northwest-specific thing, but it was a Northwest-originated thing. And there have been other community radio networks that were also born in the Northwest, including, you might argue, the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, which had its original conception here in Seattle. It was actually formed in Madison in the early 70s by folks from Seattle and elsewhere. But we've been talking about this project very focusedly with stations from the Northwest for about a year, and asking stations, you know, what is it that you need? What will help our radio stations, which are such an important part of our media landscape, do what we do better? And is there a way that we can share resources and collaborate to work together in greater strength? And we found a lot of sort of coalescence around a certain number of ideas, including that the new stations, particularly low-power FM stations that are coming online all over the region in a wonderful flowering, you know, need a lot of help. It takes a lot of work to put together, fund, and staff a radio station, and there's a lot of help out there to be given, but sometimes not so much of a structure to provide that help. That's a need out there. Another need is content sharing. It's expensive and time-consuming to produce local public affairs programming with volunteer staff. And a lot of people are doing amazing, amazing work in this area, but the work usually stays at a particular station, doesn't translate over a broader region, and therefore doesn't have access to what could be a larger natural audience that was also clearly expressed as a need. And doing collaborative production projects that allow us to share our skills across the region from station to station is something that people expressed a great interest in doing. But given that we're all so busy running our own radio stations, there's a capacity problem with reaching out even to stations that might just be right across the mountain from us, but are friends that we don't have a lot of time to work with. So these are all and more. These are all things and more that have been identified already as potential benefits of a network, and these are things that we've designed the conference this weekend around. So people have probably picked up a program book for the day. There's a blue schedule in the packets. There's a bunch of workshops, kind of a lot, like more than anybody will actually be able to attend for sure. And I want to encourage folks to, you know, sample what they need and use what we call the law of 2 feet to move from session to session if you are not getting what you need where you are. One of the things that is a thread throughout the conference session, the schedule today, is proposal sessions. And those are deliberately kind of semi-open spaces where open conversation will be directed around one or more of these proposals about how to form a network that are written up in your packet, or the guiding questions in the packet. And feel free to move from one of those to the other. Also, feel free to convene your own session. We'll have some butcher paper up on that wall right there, and there are spaces available. If there's a conversation that you need to have with a bunch of people that hasn't on the schedule now, put it in the schedule, and we'll make time for that, both today and also tomorrow morning. All right, I want to introduce our first panelists this morning, because I really want to hear what he has to say myself, actually. I'm very lucky to have Jeremy Lansman from a bunch of stations up in Anchorage. He has a really rich and storied history with community media, and particularly community radio. He was a volunteer with KPFA Berkeley in the 50s, which I guess must be when you were about 3 years old, apparently.
A little older than that.
Maybe mentally.
That would do.
He's a co-founder of CRAB, the legendary community radio station, and some argue like the first community radio station, period, in Seattle in the early 60s. He went on from CRAB to found a bunch of more community radio stations around the country, including the original KDNA. We have a KDNA in Washington, but the first one was in St. Louis. He moved up to Anchorage in the late 1980s, I think, and with his wife launched KYES, or I don't know if you launched it or not, but the KYES, TV station, which I think is the only locally owned television station.
So far as I know, outside of one individual that the Nielsen lady told me about, there are only two locally owned single owner TV station owners, local owners in the country left. The other one is about to go under.
Wow.
Whereas we're sort of holding in there for, I don't know, just barely holding in for 18 years.
Well, that...
That retirement plan didn't work out.
I'm going to turn it over to Jeremy Lansing.
Okay. Well, I want everybody to know that they're here a little bit early because we're all on the Alaska time zone. That's how I was. So it is now 7:24. did I make a mistake? But we're all a little late. Jonathan had asked me to talk a little bit about the early years of CRAB, and I thought, well, that doesn't really make sense without telling you about my entire life. So this will only take a few hours. So I actually wrote something. I haven't written anything in the way of a speech since I was like 10 years old. I'll try to scoot through it here. Let's see. It seems as though, much against my will, I have turned into an old guy. Did I write that? Bones have become weary, my eyes cloudy, not to speak of my brain, but just maybe there's an upside. It might be better to convince you that my ideas are valid and I am now an elder. Well, anyway, that's a fantasy. I was born, some were born with a silver spoon in their mouth. I received a radio tube instead. So one of my early memories was of my dad giving me a whipping for blowing out fuses. That's really true. I'm not making this up. I was, up until maybe I still am, an inarticulate nerd. However, I took articulation lessons. So, and you can understand how much of a relief it was when I discovered radio as a kid. I played around with electronic stuff, and I built my first 6L6 cigar box transmitter. I was free to speak for the first time without suffering embarrassment, correction, or recognition. This is the beauty of radio. During the early free radio learning experiences that I had, I remember playing my dad's Lead Belly Folkways recording on what was supposed to be WCBS's 880 kilohertz clear channel after they signed off at night. That was fun. I can't talk about pirate radio. A lot of you like to spend some energy trashing NPR for what they do or don't do. And yesterday saw quite a bit about valid criticism, I think, about their joining up with the commercial guys to try to keep LPFM from happening. But can you imagine what radio was like in 1955 when I was growing up and doing this stuff? You know, we had local station owners, and you know, we had local DJs, but if you could just imagine cloning thousands of Clear Channel executives and making them DJs and owners of local stations, that's what you would have had. It was a time of unbridled fear of Soviet expansion. Congress had just thrown off Joseph McCarthy and the so-called investigations of communist infiltration in the government media and the film business, only to be supplanted by the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security and the House Un-American Activities Committee, both of which later investigated Pacifica. As a result of a family divorce, I wound up sometime in the late 50s, probably around 58, as a high school student in San Francisco, rather than in St. Louis, Missouri. On weekends, I'd take the key train over the Bay Bridge, up Shattuck, to what seemed a huge space above Edie's Ice Cream Shop, where I found the only listener-supported station in the United States, and so far as I know, the world. As a volunteer, I was allowed to ride gain on live folk music programs. I heard Alan Watts, not that I understood a word of what he said, speaking about Zen, something I didn't hear, I had never heard of before, and a host of others whose ideas I really couldn't begin to comprehend. But I was there, and it was a learning experience. Little did I know that just before I arrived at KPFA, there was a volunteer who had just left. His name was Lorenzo Milam. And strangely, Lorenzo felt he could create a better station than KPFA, I learned much later. And he wanted to do that in Washington, D.C. So hiring an engineer, I learned, and a lawyer, Michael Bader, he created a not-for-profit educational corporation called, oh, yes, so creative and clever and different, Paduan Foundation. and applied for a permit to broadcast in Washington, D.C. Now, back in those early years, I continue writing here, watch my time, we used to have to provide in our application a typical week's program schedule. And with great pride, some of us who made up applications, which I did later, we would list all the great things we would broadcast, and Lorenzo did likewise. That was a mistake. As you might guess, some folks at the FCC noted the similarity of Padua to Pacifica and noted Left Coast, denoted the then Left Coast communist broadcaster. And as you might guess, Lorenzo's application was not approved. And like any good semi-despotic government, it was also not disapproved. So Lorenzo went away to Spain, where Franco had made disapproval a greater threat to life and limb, and waited for determination on his application for a new station in D.C. Well, years later, he kind of gave up and came back to the United States, and upon visiting the FCC, wandered into a friendly officer of the government who was honest enough to give him a clue. By the way, you might not know, WPFW, which is Pacifica's D.C. station, wound up on the very same frequency decades later. Anyway, as a consolation prize, Lorenzo applied for a new FM station in Seattle, Washington, where there was an empty commercial frequency, and that was as far away from Washington, D.C. as he could get. However, the application was only granted upon his signing a loyalty oath. Quite the thing. And I remember him talking about, I'm sort of straying off my script here, but he was talking about the difficulty of the decision at the time for him. The year was probably, switching ahead here, 1959. FM radio was still as popular and well-known as, well, Proust. Experts thought FM was going to die. Nobody wanted the higher-pitched sounds that came out of an FM receiver, I was told. They just turned down the treble control if they had one. I had just lost a job building a commercial AM station for a slime wad that had sufficient criminal negligence to hire a gangly kid at very low pay. That was me. A high school dropout who learned how, like most radio engineers, to do radio by building stations, pirate stations. Very common at the time. I hated Mutual News, Mercy Faith, and Daily Doses of Radio. Radio is equal to brain cotton candy. So I was looking around for something to do that earned money before my mom kicked me out of the house. And I found an ad in Broadcasting Magazine, some station way off in Seattle asking for an engineer. And it sounded kind of intriguing, the ad. It was in Broadcasting. And I wound up in Seattle knocking on the door. How are we doing on time here? I was an applicant for a job. I wasn't really a co-founder, okay? I knocked on the door. Other people. Lorenzo had a couple of friends, and they had founded this. Actually, the licensee was private. Lorenzo was the owner at the time. He made it as simple as he could because of the conflict he had had years before. Before the first KRAB broadcast, Lorenzo had made some effort at publicity. To me, he had a natural attraction to newsprint that included words about him and his works. So piles of newspapers collected in corners of the Crab studio, which was on Roosevelt Avenue in a little donut shop. And there was a little bit of publicity about the new signal on 107.7 the first night. So scooting out on those silky, smooth FM waves, the first night was a recording of a raga. What was that? It was probably performed by Ravi Shankar. I'd never heard anything like that. Just noise to me. But I'm just a kid. What do I know? What I do know is that Gary Margeson, who still lives here, is probably not too far from where I'm sitting right now, answered one of the few phone calls that came in to the new Crab telephone. And it was from a listener who claimed her son could play better than that noise, to which he replied, "Bring him over. We'll put him on the air." KRAB was the opposite of everything I'd ever thought was important to a radio station. Announcing was laconic, dead air was not just allowed, but respected. Programs were esoteric, challenging to fathom, assuming you could glean anything from all the programs put on because of their ideas. people came by to learn more about the station and to buy a radio to hear it, as FM sets could not be found for under $200 in current dollar value. The station lived off of Lorenzo's inherited wealth, much of which was locked into a trust which he frequently bitterly complained about having to break into. It was a trust his family, didn't trust him. One day, Lorenzo insisted I receive pay, and to do this, he needed my Social Security number, which I didn't know. So he made one up, and that's the one I use today. And I know it works because they send me statements. It's been going on so long, I guess it's like government lying, you know. If you say it often enough, they believe you. So, let's see. Maybe I should skip ahead. There was KPFA back then, and KPFK had gotten on the air not too long before in WBAI. In Seattle, there was KING-FM, which was the classical, almost private channel of the family that owned that station. Down in San Francisco, there was a church station where KQED-FM sits today, and the school station, KALW, played school programs. So that, what I wanted to do is give you a little bit of a sense of the poverty of ideas that were in the air at the time. In 1963, a small but dignified assortment of four listener-supported FM stations raised money by politely requesting that listeners subscribe. In return, the listener received a monthly program guide. Pacifica stations sent a flyer called a folio, and KRAB sent out a guide that included Lorenzo's pithy essay, later captured as a book called The Merkin Papers. At some forgotten date, Lorenzo and company had the idea to do a marathon, which was a novel new idea, to play especially good programs interspersed with somewhat less polite pitches for subscriptions. That was a faithful action that no doubt prompted by the newly emptied inherited trust fund that Lorenzo was not able to crack at the time. I'm sorry to say that the idea caught on and the pitches became less polite year by year. And that's what we have now throughout what we call public radio and community radio. Like any good radio visionary, I was as sure Lorenzo and company were doing radio the wrong way as he wasn't thinking Pacifica had erred from the true path. So having learned something about how to file for a radio station construction permit from the master, I moved to bring a station to the place I grew up, St. Louis, Missouri. So it was that I moved back to St. Louis and built a radio station. It's a long story in the middle, but whatever. Anyway, before on the way, I remember setting up KBOO in Portland. You'd like me to concentrate on the Pacific Northwest. KBOO was the dream of a woman who, poor dear, wanted to have classical music on radio. The dream grew into nothing like that. I remember meeting with her, ultimately Lorenzo and I, and we worked out an application for a 10-watt Class D license on 90.7 after leaving a bunch of prospective program guides around the area from Vancouver to Eugene, stuffed with envelopes in which the reader could enclose a check. The response was underwhelming. There were a few, leading me to go up the street from KRAB to the station on the next block, which was KISW with a little tower at that time. And one evening after they signed off, I climbed up their tower with a tape measure, noting the dimensions of their antenna, took the drawings to a machine shop, and scaling for the difference in frequency, had the shop fabricate some not really commercial Andrew FM broadcast antennas. A call by me to KPFK revealed that they had some unused transmitting gear, an exciter, a real junker that they sent me for nothing. And that wound up at the Council Crest KBOO transmitter site. I strung up an antenna. You know, none of this is on the KBOO website. I did a lot of jumping around on the internet to find out about my past. It's amazing. There are things I'd forget, and then I'd go look, and I'd see something. And I remember that. Well, KBOO doesn't have any of this stuff. So strung up an antenna. KBOO started out as a translator, practically speaking, of KRAB. And it didn't work very well. I guess it faded out a lot. But I was on my way to St. Louis, so what would I care? I was gone by then. So let's see. Leaving, I left Portland with 10-kilowatt transmitter in the back of a huge rental truck. And I knew that I could bring a smorgasbord of esoteric music literature, readings, and other things I had learned about, Coltrane, the Ramayana monkey chant, Tibetan temple bells, while playing some of the music my generation, Arlo Guthrie, Dylan, Baez, just to name a few, would also be mixed in to attract a large enough audience that the station could survive as a commercial station. Yes, I thought it could be commercial. And in retrospect, it might have been a very successful station if only I had tossed out the Coltrane, the chants, and the temple bells. A year or two into it, what had become a little collective of people voted to stay free, free of commercials, and keeping the freedom to broadcast what we pleased. Did I say collective? Maybe commune would be right. It was 1969, thereabouts. I had a strong belief then that radio and the KDNA could be the main hallway in the marketplace of ideas, that people of all persuasions, if given a chance, would come to a mutual understanding about what's best for our society. My station, much like Crab, would openly solicit people to air their thoughts, regardless of how much I found them offensive. And therefore, besides Leonard Slatkin, a conductor at the time at the St. Louis Symphony, we had Black Panthers, Nazis, SDS, and John Birch Society speakers on our station. And often they would meet each other between programs, and it was so much fun to see the Nazis talking with the Black Panthers. I really did love it. That was the whole point of it. So what I can tell you now is that governments don't enjoy dissent. And as a radio station operator during the Vietnam War, although I felt the station should be neutral, and even though we had a rule that anyone could have airtime without question for 15 minutes, there were those who would seek to shut us down and what pursued. I'm giving the hook here. We were busted for possession of dope. Everybody in the station was hauled away, and I have to tell you that you could never prove it, but they brought their own in case they couldn't find what they knew was there. So I guess when you run something that's an open voice of that allows open voice of dissent, and even though the station itself may not have a focus, which we tried not to have, at least we tried to be open to everybody, that didn't make any difference. And I think that's also the story of Pacifica in the early years. So I'll just leave it at that. There could be more questions, but at some point, I'm in St. Louis, and I guess it had to be very early 70s, and Sharon, OKRAB, was, Lorenzo left that. And so, shall I turn it over?
Well, thanks, Jeremy, and thanks, Jeremy. And I'm sorry to be a bit draconian about the time. I want to make sure that we have time to hear everything, and then hopefully have some time for some questions, actually. Jeremy will be around during the day also. I did want to get a chance to make sure we could hear from our other distinguished guest this morning, Sharon Maeda, who also has a long storied history in community radio in the Northwest and in the country. In fact, she was a general manager of KRAB Seattle in the late 1970s, closer to the unfortunate end of that station's history in Seattle. She also was a producer at KCTS Seattle, executive director of the Pacifica network in the 1980s. A decade when she also served in HUD under Henry Cisneros during the Clinton administration, and throughout her career has been a strong advocate for social and racial justice, both in our communities and in the world of public broadcasting. She's done a lot of things. She's on the ITU board that you're sitting on as well? You told me the story when the satellite.
Oh, it's the public telecommunications satellite trust.
She told me one time that she's one of the handful of people who actually has her thumb on the satellite path. So if things really get bad, then she controls the satellites. So that's good to know that she's a friend of ours. has helped set up radio stations all around the world, including in sub-Saharan Africa, and is a great resource for community broadcasters, young and old. So thank you. Sharon, please.
Thank you, Jonathan. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through a whole long history. One of the things that I've learned over the years is that the history of community radio, like the history of many other things in this country, gets sort of a revisionist bent to it, and there's a lot of things that are omitted or covered in a way that is not entirely truthful. So I'm going to pick just a few selected items and be selective myself. I'll say that at the beginning. Some years ago, about a few weeks before his death, Samori Marksman, who was the wonderful program director of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, a few weeks before he suddenly passed away, it was an anniversary of Pacifica, so he decided to interview me to talk about my tenure there and some of the things that happened in the 80s. And he said to me live on the air, did you know that out of the 8 books written about the history of Pacifica Radio, your name is not mentioned once? And I said, well, no, I didn't know that because I know who the 8 writers are and I chose not to read those books. But he went on to talk about how Pacifica's history, as illustrious as it is and as much as Pacifica has done for the country and to some degree for the world in terms of being an outlet, there are also many things about Pacifica that should be known because it wasn't all a rosy history. I'll begin with KPFA, the first Pacifica station in Berkeley. When I got to Pacifica in 1980, there was a line item in the budget for office space in Oakland. And I knew we had no station in Oakland. The station was in Berkeley. So I tried to figure out what that was all about, and it turns out many, many years before, there was a class action race discrimination suit that was filed against KPFA on behalf of communities of color. And that Oakland storefront was the Third World News Bureau. In other words, the news that was coming from KPFA, as politically progressive as it might have been in content, was not allowing people of color back in the 70s to tell their stories and bring the news from their communities into the an integrated approach to the news or more inclusive approach to the news. So they sued and they won. And part of the settlement was they would have their own separate but equal news bureau in Oakland. And that went on for years and years and years. And KPFA made no attempt over the years to move some of these folks into the news, general news operation. So it remained for over a decade a separate situation. Well, I put a stop to that. It tells you that even in the name of progressive politics or the name of access or the name of inclusion, that there were many, many things that were happening then, and I would venture to say there are many things that are happening today in community radio where not everyone has access. It's one thing to have some guests on a program. It's another thing for the people to be involved in the general operations, governance, and throughout the structure, on the board of directors, whatever, of community radio. And speaking of the Northwest creating some new things, back in, I can't remember if it was 1978 or 79, some of you were there, there was an NFCB, National Federation of Community Broadcasters, meeting in Olympia, hosted by KAOS, the Evergreen College station. And at that conference that had several hundred people, there were 13 people of color that were there. And that was the creation of the Third World Caucus, I believe we called ourselves. and a list of demands that we put before the body to have minority training programs, to have scholarships for people of color to come to the conference. And that was the birth of what eventually became the Minority Producers Conference that was held, I think, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and many other things. And a lot of the people that you know today who are people of color that have started community radio stations around the country, particularly in the West, they came out of that original group of 13 people who started that issue to be put forward. And in NFCB's case, it was not about any kind of particular discrimination. It was just nobody noticed that we weren't at the table. And NFCB had been in existence for quite a few years. So again, another piece of community radio history was born here in the Pacific Northwest. Now I want to switch to the upside of all of that. Community radio, as you know, as the voice of the people, has enormous impact. And one of the things that Pacifica is well known for, unfortunately, is the internal political strife and cabals that happened a few years ago. It was heightened to the point where there was really a risk of losing one or more of the frequencies. WBAI in New York, if they do not pay their antenna fees to the Empire State Building, they can get kicked off immediately. And the whole operation of Pacifica was in such a dire strait financially that they could have gone under. And with the World Trade Center 9/11 situation, there is no other option in New York City for a tower. So if they were a few days late on their rent, they could have easily lost their ability to broadcast in the New York tri-state market. But I'm going to just end with a few items of extraordinary importance, what the airwaves have to offer, not only the people in your own community or in the country, but in the world. And that is a very, very serious responsibility, and the internal political strife and the conflicts that happen within a community station cannot derail the larger purpose that you have, regardless of your politics or whether it's music or whatever it is that you're airing. So I want to end with several examples of really wonderful things that happened. On the 10th anniversary of the Soweto Uprising, the anti-apartheid activists in South Africa, let Pacifica Radio know that Botha, who was the last of the apartheid presidents of South Africa, was ordering his military to go to Soweto and to shut down any kind of commemorative activities that might be happening on the 10th anniversary. Pacifica had, a few years before, gone to the U.S. Supreme Court and successfully won the right to editorialize. It was our belief that if commercial broadcasters who are only there to sell products have a right to editorialize, then surely non-commercial broadcasters who were not owing their existence to products should certainly have the right to editorialize. So we had won that right, but we had agreed that we would not editorialize about local issues such as potholes or anything like that, and that it would only be something that was of major significance. But we never really set a policy, and we never really got around to deciding to editorialize on anything. When we had that word from our correspondent in Johannesburg that the military in South Africa was moving into Soweto, and this was about a week before the anniversary, we decided that that was exactly the time to use our right to editorialize for the first time. And so Jack O'Dell, who was the chair of our board, who's a longtime civil rights advocate, went into the station and gave an editorial. It was the first time in my memory that everyone up and down the line in Pacifica agreed unanimously on what to do. No one questioned it. It was a 5-minute decision at a national board meeting, and no one edited or even looked at what Jack said in his editorial. We put it on the satellite. That was the means of distribution at that time. We put it on the satellite, and the managers of the 5 Pacifica stations agreed to broadcast that editorial every hour on the hour for the entire week. The editorial was tagged with the White House comment line, phone line, and the request was tell Reagan to tell Bolta that you cannot do anything to the people that will be commemorating the 10th anniversary or the entire world will be against you. Because Bolta and Reagan were close friends. The upshot of that was that not only did the 5 Pacifica stations, but all the stations around the country that were affiliates of Pacifica, we urged them to write their own editorials, but what they did is they just took Jack's editorial and ran it every hour on the hour. We'll never know absolutely for sure, but when I anonymously called the White House and asked if they had received a lot of calls, the answer was, it was a very strange situation that happened. For the first 5 or 10 minutes of every hour, the phone lines were totally jammed. And then the calls would die down, and then the next hour the calls would pick up again. And we actually blew the White House comment line more than once. We don't know how many calls actually went in, but they also said it was very strange because calls were coming in from places like Yellow Springs, Ohio, and Telluride, Colorado, and all the places we know that there are strong community radio stations. So that's the power. That's the power of, and there was no one touched. None of the military touched anybody in Soweto on that 10th anniversary. So that's one of the examples of the power that you have and how precious that is and how responsible you have to be when you use it. Another similar example was when Reverend Jackson ran for president in 1984, Pacifica recorded a number of his speeches, and we just put it free on the satellite for anybody to take down, with Reverend Jackson's permission, of course. And I happened to be at a meeting that he had after the election, and he was thanking everybody and so on, and he said, and you know what? We won in, and he started naming these small towns and places where there were community radio stations. He had no idea. He said, I never even went there. I've never been there. You know, how did that happen? Well, we knew, because when Reverend Jackson's speeches were put on the air, people had an alternative, and they voted their conscience. And I'm getting the signal that it's time to close out. I just want to quickly say, Pacifica pioneered a whole bunch of things that we take for granted today. The live talk show, classical music, the audio bridge. Their first call was to Moscow to connect ordinary people in Berkeley to ordinary people in Moscow. The live hearing, the HUAC hearings, Pacifica aired live. The live radio drama. And someone who never gets recognition, Elsa Knight Thompson, who was the first public affairs and news director of KPFA, demanded the truth in news, journalism, and real ethics in what they put out on the airwaves. And that's the legacy that you all have in front of you, and I hope you'll use the airwaves accordingly. Thank you.